You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Stella toku ingoa, nau mai, haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for this Rapare Thursday. I'm your host Stella and I'll be with you with producer Millie for the next hour. This week on the show, I speak to Edgardo Valdez Lopez, the Cuban ambassador to New Zealand and member of the Auckland Cuba Friendship Society, Ana Lucia, about the anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis and the UN's discussion of urging the US to lift sanctions on Cuba. I speak to Penny Hulse, panel member on the Future for Local Government report. Tuva'a has his weekly catch-up with Labour's Andrew Little, and Francis takes the Green Desk talking about a new flooding report. Finally, Millie chats to Alan Rikers from Forest and Bird about the Bird of the Year results. We would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so tuku patuhi mai, you can text me on 5395 or give us a call in studio on 309 3879. And remember, you can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website.
I don't know, and frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Now let's get into the Thursday Wire. Today and yesterday, the UN is voting for the 29th time on a resolution against US economic, commercial and financial embargoes against Cuba. It coincides with the 60th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Today, I spoke to the Cuban ambassador to New Zealand, Edgardo Valdez Lopez, on the matter and started by asking what the Cuban people's perspectives on the event of the Cuban Missile Crisis are.
Well, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis was a result of a very aggressive policy that the U.S. Government developed towards Cuba since 1959, when the Cuban Revolution triumphed. You have to take into consideration that in April 1961, Cuba was militarily invaded. There were more plans. That invasion was defeated in less than 72 hours. And as a result of that, the U.S. government was planning a direct military invasion in Cuba afterwards. So Cuba was under a lot of pressures and a lot of risk, and we were very concerned about our security. And at that time, it was a moment of a lot of tension because Cubans were ready to defend our sovereignty at any cost. And at the end of the day, it resulted that there was an agreement and the crisis was resolved, but we were ready to even disappear from the map in order to not to give up our independence. The agreement that was achieved between at that time the Soviet Union and the U.S. did not take into consideration Cuban's concerns, because if it is true that the U.S. government gave assurances to the USSR that they would not invade Cuba, there were many other actions and sanctions that kept into place and that are continuing until nowadays. For example, the U.S. have a blockade against Cuba. In 2 days, the General Assembly of the United Nations will be considering a resolution that is called the necessity of ending the U.S. commercial, economic and financial blockade against Cuba. This resolution has been adopted by the General Assembly 29 times, and the U.S. is not doing anything regarding this. So in that moment, if it is true that the nuclear threat disappeared because of the negotiations and everything, the results that we were expecting were not achieved, and we are still suffering the consequences. So in general, I would say in very few words that we were not happy with the decision. We were not happy with the way that it was solved. But at the same time, you know, the positive side of this was that there was not a direct confrontation between two important superpowers.
And do you think that Western nations in general acknowledge the Cuban perspective enough in discourse surrounding the event?
You know, unfortunately, you know, that nowadays, especially, you know, the ones that control the important networks and social media and everything are the ones who decide when you start to analyze a historic event or something. Then usually the most widespread version of the crisis begins when the efficient U.S. espionage apparatus discovered that the Soviet Union is installing missiles in Cuba. But nobody mentions that the U.S. has already established missiles in Turkish territory. Nobody mentions the Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961 in Cuba. And nobody mentions a lot of plans aimed at justifying new military invasions against Cuba that were taking place at that time. So the crisis was not the result of any aggressive stand on the part of Cuba or the Soviet Union, but because of the, you know, the threatening and aggressive policy that the U.S. was developing towards Cuba and the USSR.
So as you mentioned, the UN General Assembly has approved such a motion of a resolution against U.S. sanctions against Cuba 29 times in a row. Do you believe that this time will have a different outcome?
No. In every occasion, it has been approved by the overwhelming majority of the UN General Assembly. In fact, only the U.S. and Israel voted against that resolution in the last voting. We hope that this year it will be approved, that it will be approved by the big majority of countries. But what we don't think will change is that the U.S. Is not taking into consideration the objective of this resolution. Now, they are talking a lot about a war based on rules. They are talking a lot about the role of the United Nations. They are presenting themselves as defenders of the United Nations. But at the same time, they have not been taken into consideration 29 resolutions, and we hope that 30 resolutions against the policy towards Cuba for many, many years now.
So to speak specifically about the blockades, how have they been hindering the Cuban state's efforts to, for example, meet the objectives of the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development? How has the blockade been hindering Cuba as a nation?
Well, it hinders every aspect of our life. For example, not only in Cuba, also in other countries, for Cubans in other countries, and for other countries in their relations with Cuba. You know, everything is very difficult for Cuba. You know, for example, if we cannot buy any product that contains more than 10% of American components, and this is very difficult nowadays in the world to find products that do not have, and no country is allowed to buy Cuban products that have more than 10% of Cuban components. So it affects our relationship with the whole world. We usually, in the past, had a lot of trade with the U.S. It's very close. They had good and cheap products and everything. And now we have to go through China or Vietnam or Europe in order to buy the same products, so we have to pay a higher price, we have to spend a lot of money in transportation and everything, so it has an impact in the Cuban population. But even inside, outside of Cuba, for example, Cubans are limited to make bank operations, including our embassy here in New Zealand have difficulty in operating with the banks because of the U.S. regulations, because it has an extraterritorial effect. And it has an important impact in our efforts to comply with the Agenda 2030, because it affects all aspects of our economy, our social life, and everything. We are doing a great effort in order to comply with these objectives, and we are getting some results, but it's extremely difficult for us. For example, during the COVID pandemic, we were not allowed to buy vaccines. We were not able to buy vaccines outside. We have to develop our own vaccines. We were successful, and we have the pandemic under control in Cuba. the borders are open, people are able to visit the country, and the economy is starting to recover. But we always have more difficulties because it was difficult for us to get access to equipment, to raw materials in order to produce the vaccines. And it's always the same with all the situations that we face. We have more difficulties than any other country in order to solve any of the regular or normal problems that any country has. This is not something that only affects the Cuban people. It also affects New Zealand companies and people. You know, I have had some emails from New Zealand citizens that have a relative in Cuba and they want to send them a gift for a birthday or send some money to help them with their studies there or something like that. And they cannot do that because the banks would not accept this kind of transactions. And New Zealand companies that have trade with Cuba have difficulties in order to pay for the products that they buy in Cuba because of all these regulations. Nowadays, there are some new measures trying to prevent New Zealanders to travel to Cuba, and they are they have to apply for a special visit to enter the United States if they visit Cuba. So every time there are new measures trying to tighten this embargo blockade, and these measures do not affect only Cubans, but also the all other countries and citizens around the world.
That was me speaking to the Cuban ambassador to New Zealand, Edgardo Valdez Lopez, about the 60th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis and US sanctions against Cuba. And the Auckland-Cuba Friendship Society is hosting an event this evening to mark the 60th anniversary and is hosting Mr. Valdez Lopez for a Q&A discussion. I spoke to a member of the society, Ana Lucia, about the event and the significance of the vote at the UN and anniversary on members of the society and Cubans in Aotearoa. I started by asking about the history of the Cuba Friendship Society.
The Cuba Friendship Society's been around in New Zealand since the late 1960s, from memory. I obviously wasn't involved at that point, but basically it was people who were inspired by the example of the Cuban Revolution who came together to do whatever they could to both support the revolutionary process in Cuba, but also, more importantly, to get the truth out about what was happening in Cuba around the world, because Cuba was sort of faced with an economic embargo and a information campaign from Washington that was unrelenting, and it was important for other sources to try and get word out about what the situation really is in Cuba.
Could you explain for listeners the event that you're holding this evening?
On November the 2nd and 3rd, the United Nations is having a vote on the US economic embargo. This is an embargo that's been in place for more than 60 years. And an overwhelming majority of members of the General Assembly vote against the embargo and have done so more than, I think it's 29 times. This evening we're taking advantage of the fact that it's the 60th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis, which has been a lot of discussion about recently as the last time that the world came to nuclear brinkmanship. But what happened in 1962 was that the Soviet Union decided to put MIF in Cuba, and the United States basically was threatening to invade Cuba as a result of that. The Cubans had agreed to this, not primarily in terms of the need for self-defense, but as part of an act of solidarity with forces around the world who were facing aggression from Washington at the time. The standoff was actually that Kennedy decided to back down once he actually appreciated the actual cost of an invasion of Cuba would be. Kennedy's own advisors told him that within a few days there'd be tens of thousands of casualties as a result of an invasion. Not because of the missiles, but because of the preparedness of the Cuban people to defend themselves. And that was shown just a year earlier when the US did try to invade using proxy forces were defeated at what was known as the Bay of Pigs invasion. The Cuban people mobilized in defense of the revolution and defeated that invasion. The fact is that for more than 60 years, Washington has maintained a brutal embargo that's cost the Cuban people hugely, but the Cuban people are determined to defend their sovereignty and make their own choices about the kind of political and economic system that they have in their country without sort of being dictated to by the sort of capitalist forces in Washington who had always thought that Cuba was their playground up until then.
So for this evening, do you mind sharing maybe some of the questions you have planned for the ambassador? What will the discussion in general be about?
So we'll be discussing both the current cost of the ongoing embargo and the impact that's having on Cuba, as well as, you know, what the real history of the Cuban experience was around the missile crisis. There's a lot of discussion in the media about what happened in Washington and in Moscow, but very little about the Cuban experience and both their view of the way they were treated by either the Soviet Union or Washington. So that will be very much a part of the discussion. I actually happen to know that there will be veterans from Cuba of the missile crisis experience who'll give a bit of their first-hand account of how they were prepared to defend the revolution at that time. And more importantly, is sort of the what the ambassador sees is the need to sort of end the embargo today. How we can help advance that effort. The New Zealand government has regularly voted against Washington in the imposition of the embargo. But despite that, many New Zealand businesses and companies maintain, sort of abide by the embargo because they have US parent companies. So, for example, the ANZ will not provide any banking services to anyone who is from Cuba, has a Cuban passport, or even though this is not New Zealand regulations, but they abide by it because they're afraid of US Treasury placing fines on them for breaching the US embargo.
And what are the details of the event this evening for people who might be interested in attending?
So we'll be meeting at 6 p.m. At the Unite offices, which is in 6A Western Springs Road in Kingsland.
That was me speaking to Anna Lucia from the Auckland Cuba Friendship Society about their event this evening to mark the 60th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis and discuss US sanctions against Cuba with the Cuban ambassador to New Zealand, Edgardo Valdez Lopez. And I'll be back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
What's a seven-letter word for Street Fighter?
No idea. I know that tonight at Ponsonby Social Club there's
a live tribute to Tyler the Creator and Frank Ocean, followed by Carlotta and Cartier.
And tomorrow,
DJs Bobby Brazuka and Soultry.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
Yes, I am. The rhythm selection, you know. Every Monday night from 9 till 11, Dubbed and Guest Selectors play the full range of ghetto sound. Yeah, man. From rock steady to roots reggae, beat bop sound to hip hop, dub style, true to the latest dance vibes. Yeah, man. The rhythm selection. Boy, the rhythm selection. Why? The rhythm selection, boy. From 9 to 11 and 95 FM, Dobe Dam Ye Selectors, the rhythm selection.
We'll be right back. Naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
Welcome back. You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. And remember, you can let us know what you think about these pieces. Just text in on 5395. A review into the future of local government is in its consultation phase and a draft has just been released. I spoke to Penny Hulse, a panel member of the review. Here we are now.
Sure. So the draft, we're producing a draft report which reviews local government and looks at how to make it fit for purpose for the next 30 years. And the review was instigated by the Minister for Local Government, Nanaia Mahuta, and the panel of five of us has been appointed to come up with three iterations. We produced an interim report which looked at all the issues. We've now got a draft report after we've been out and talked to the local government sector, community, iwi Māori, and the wider public. The draft report's now out for consultation, and then we'll give the Minister a final report in June next year.
Ensuring people are engaged with democracy is obviously kind of a hot topic after the turnout at Tamaki Makaurau's local elections in particular this year. So what were your key findings around revitalising citizen-led democracy?
this is probably one of the things that I'm personally most passionate about, and certainly after the election seems to be one of the most critical issues. People are losing confidence in democratic institutions, they're turning away from voting, and they've just lost kind of trust and interest. So for re-engaging the community in local government in particular, we're looking at how we can, first of all, we've made some suggestions about elections and how the election process is conducted. And we're also looking in the longer term at the change in how people view democracy. You know, at the moment, you have an election every 3 years, you elect people to sit around the table, make decisions on your behalf. And we're saying, when you look around the world, that's no longer good enough. And participatory democracy, citizens, juries, and ways that the community themselves can get involved and make decisions, I think is the way of the future.
And in a similar vein, multiple mayors have publicly pushed back against central government's Three Waters proposal this week. So what does the report have to say about strengthening the relationship between central and local government?
Yeah, to be honest, you know, the relationship between central government and local government is pretty ropey at the moment from both sides, you know, and I think this has been unfolding for a long time. But we're really clear that local government is an absolutely critical partner for central government, and central government should take every opportunity they can with, you know, the big gnarly problems of climate change and loss of social cohesion and, you know, loss of hope by some of our young rangatahi and our young people that we're seeing playing out with things like ram raids. You know, local government is the layer of governance closest to the people, and often the community and local government have the answers that central government needs. So, you know, two things. We're saying central government, please think about local government as your first port of call, as your partner to work with. And secondly, let's engage on what funding looks like, because local government, to be absolutely blunt, is running out of money, and that's what is frustrating people.
What is the general consensus from survey respondents and from the report itself about the management of local assets? Are the public aware of the power that local government actually hold over services that we interact with so often?
This is one of the problems. You know, you start, for sort of a local government tragic like me, you know, you start to sort of talk to people about how amazing local government is and its potential as an anchor institution to do good and placemake and make change in your community, and people's eyes glaze over. But if you think about councils, you know, they touch every part of your lives and have the potential to really change people's experience of the communities they live in. And mostly councils do a pretty good job of this, but the huge issues of growth, particularly in Tamaki Makaurau, it's increasingly challenging to find the money just through rates to pay for everything that's needed. And this circles back to, we need to work with central government to look at how we can fund intergenerational assets and just lift that burden off the ratepayers a little bit, so that people can see it's not all just about paying their rates. They can actually see the benefits of what's happening in the community. But one of the small key things that we're suggesting in our report is also greater civics education, telling people how councils work and how to get involved, and maybe starting to uncover a little bit of that enthusiasm in communities for, you know, how they can interact and participate with council and the place they live in.
And you've touched on this, but what are the recommendations that the report has for ensuring a tiriti perspective is kind of woven into the fabric of local government?
One of the recommendations that's probably, you know, it's caused a few ripples, but we're saying, in its simplest terms, to be a good tiriti partner is really critical for local government. And there's a variety of ways that relationships have unfolded around the motu. Some councils have fantastic relationships, some councils don't. One of our recommendations is that councils are required to seek out ways to improve their relationship with iwi Māori in their area, and also to look at ways to make their council processes reflect the tikanga of the community in which they operate. this has come the 30-year time frame, but we're just saying let's make council processes safe, open and available to all. And as part of that, let's also look at how we increase mana whenua representation around the council table. So we're proposing and we'll be consulting on how people feel about having appointed mana whenua reps around the council table as well as Māori wards. So having the people from the place sit at that council table as well.
And just finally, what is the timeline to completion looking like at this stage?
So it's a pretty, even though, you know, you think a couple of years is a long time, it's pretty tight. We're just embarking on a roadshow around Aotearoa over the next few weeks to fit in pretty much every region and many councils prior to Christmas. We've got submissions through till February the 28th, and we're hoping to have the final report in June 2023. So it's a tight time frame, but if I can just put a bit of a shout out there to people, have a look. It's not too onerous. There's a shortened executive summary, and please make submissions. What do you love? What do you hate? And what better ideas have you got for local government? Because it's pretty important to all our communities and to Aotearoa into the future.
That was me speaking to Penny Hulse, a panel member on the review into the future of local government. Our weekly catch-up with Labour's Andrew Little is back. Tava'a had a chat with him this morning. Here they are now.
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labour MP Andrew Little.
Last week you announced Te Pae Tata, the interim New Zealand health plan for the next 2 years. Could you please outline what the plan entails?
Yeah, there's a number of things to it. There's about 120 different actions or tasks to be taken. It's called the interim plan because it's just for 2 years. The future that we've set up is that the funding cycle for health will follow a three-year pattern. So at the beginning of each parliamentary term, the government of the day will approve a three-year budget for health. And so future plans will have a three-year time frame. But this one, it's really about starting a whole lot of stuff that we know desperately needs to be done, including as a priority the workforce issues. So continuing with the stuff we've done on recruiting more people to fill the vacancies at the moment, but just as importantly, laying the foundation for the long-term future pipeline of health workers. So working with the tertiary sector who train medical graduates and nursing students and what have you. So we're building our own, and also working out pathways for entry to health work. We know a lot of people who don't go from school into tertiary education, but you know, do work in the health system and have aspirations to want to go into clinical roles and more qualified roles, and finding pathways for them to do that. And then there's the, I think, addressing some of these specific issues, obviously health inequities for Māori and Pacific, but also looking at services for rural communities and how we improve what we do for that, you know, that part of the population. So quite a wide range of stuff. There's some health areas that are going to be given specific emphasis, so that includes maternal care and the first years of a new baby's life. Better care for cancer patients, knowing that there's a large number of them and quite diverse needs depending on the cancers that people have. And so those are two new sort of priority areas that are opening up in terms of the services that we want to see improved.
So as you're saying, you're going to be moving to a three-year funding cycle. What's the benefits of this over a single-year funding cycle? Is it quite a game changer?
Yeah, it is. It gives greater certainty, and particularly, you know, we have our public hospitals and what have you, but a large part of the health dollar goes to what are effectively private organisations, a lot of community organisations, but also, you know, things like your GP practices and others. So having a three-year cycle then means that the likes of Te Whatu Ora and Te Aka Whai Ora can make longer-term decisions and enter contracts with third parties that can give greater certainty to them, so that those organisations can take on staff knowing that there's going to be some certainty from 1 year to the next. It's not going to be a year-by-year sort of thing. We know that, for example, in the vaccination campaign and with COVID, a lot of the community health organisations they got additional funding and they staffed up to do some amazing work, but a lot of those funding agreements sort of come to an end soon, and it's kind of what next, because they've got a whole bunch of people who've done great stuff, keen to work, continue to work in the health sector and continue to do work for which there is a need at the moment, and so changing that funding cycle just gives greater certainty for organisations like that.
You've said in the past that a lot of the issues faced by the health sector today are carryovers from the last national government. Dr. Shane Reti said he was sick of excuses, and after 5 years of Labour, the current government was at fault. At what point after the new government comes in is the old government no longer responsible for the health system, do you think?
I think two things. First of all, the government of the day is always responsible for what happens and the decisions that they take. So we've made a lot of decisions, a lot of big and significant decisions. Certainly funding, we've increased health funding by nearly 45% in the 5 years we've been in government, and that reflects the fact that it was, seriously underfunded. Part of that funding has paid for quite a few additional roles, 5,000 more nurses, a lot more specialists in our health system. And we've also increased funding for infrastructure, so new buildings and new facilities. So we have a $7 billion building program across our hospital network at the moment. That compares with about $1.2 billion spent by the previous government over their 9 years. The second point I'd make is that actually the decisions in health that you take today, the impact is really felt in, the 5 to 10 years that follow. And that's what we're effectively responding to now is a series of decisions that go back 10 to 15 years. And in fairness too, they go back further than that. You probably go back 30 years. I know some of the commentators say that this has been a kind of a systemic under-resourcing spanning a large number of years. That's actually what we're dealing with. And I think, we'll do everything we can. But knowing that when we make decisions, investment decisions, or even some of the big policy decisions, the big reforms that we're making of taking the 20 DHBs out, putting into Te Whatu Ora Health New Zealand in, and Te Aka Whai Ora, the Māori Health Authority, they are working now on building the structures and processes and stuff to get better decision-making to better support patients. But that's going to take a while for that to bed in and become business as usual. So that takes some time to do that. I think it's just about acknowledging that in a system as large and as complex as the health system, decisions taken today affect what happens 5 to 10 years later. And so if you make the wrong decisions on the wrong course, it's 5 to 10 years later that you're either going to get the benefits or you're going to get the challenges that poses, and that's what we're dealing with at the moment.
Last week you were also at the University of Waikato announcing the start of the Enhanced Mental Health and Addiction Services on campus, the last of the country's 8 universities to roll out the expansion. What kind of support can students get in the student wellbeing package?
Yeah, I did that yesterday. So what they can expect is more people available to provide the type of support that students need. So at Waikato, the extra funding they've got, they are spending on 4 additional positions. They've got one's an additional mental health counsellor, another is a social worker, so for people who need to be plugged into other social agencies. Another is an alcohol and drugs counsellor. We know that's a serious problem and for a number of students on campuses right around the country. And the other is a violence prevention coordinator. So understanding that students are as much victims of violence. And the sort of violence they're talking about is not necessarily, aggressive physical stuff. It's the failure to understand what consent means when it comes to sexual relations, and failure to understand how to conduct yourself in healthy personal relationships. So all of those things will make a big difference. And talking to some of the student reps and the students who were there yesterday, they were very appreciative of that and telling me, the argument that they put up for why these positions are needed and the difference that they will make. So, that's encouraging. So now, what that means now is that with Waikato having got those roles on board, And all other universities and polytechs now have got additional resourcing and support. I think the other thing we're expecting is that, you know, the generation of young people have gone through COVID, their school years through COVID, and there's still going to be ongoing challenges as people adapt to and change and kind of respond to the way they've been affected by COVID. And having that additional support in our tertiary institutions for high school students have come through that experience, I think it's going to be important too.
That was Labor MP Andrew Little. The Wire.
That was Tava'a speaking to Labor's Andrew Little, and I'll be right back after this short break.
95BFM is thrilled to present Kay Tempest at The Power Station on Friday, 24th February.
More pressure, more release, more relief, more belief.
One of the most overwhelmingly acclaimed writers and performers on the planet, Kay Tempest is truly an artist of a generation. Incendiary, emotional, and beautiful.
More pressure, more release. Your
Kay Tempest
cheeks,
at the Power Station for one very desire, special night only. Be quick complex, for tickets at complete. Ticketmaster. On sale now.
Residency, where Friday night meets Saturday morning. Specialty mixes from Related Articles, Index Records, Heat Rockers Records, and the Big Fresh Collective.
But then what makes the world go round?
Residency. Hottest DJs from Aotearoa and beyond. Residency, Saturdays at 1 a.m. only on 95BFM.
What's his title? The guy in charge, Dr. Ashley Broom?
The Director General of Health.
Yeah.
The Wire.
Welcome back. You're tuned into The Wire.
Trees. Mountains. A curious kittadoo.
It's time for the Green Desk with Francis on 95BFM.
After Westport was hit by devastating floods in July last year, the government was prompted to release a report, which came out yesterday, giving a snapshot on the scale of flood hazard exposure for vulnerable communities around Aotearoa. The report has essentially found that dozens of communities are at serious risk of flooding and are totally unprepared for it. 9 of the 44 affected communities are in the Tairawhiti district, which the region's mayor says is not unexpected. For the Green Desk this week, to follow up on what the report means in Tairawhiti and what the changing climate means with increased flooding, I caught up with Emergency Manager Ben Green. Here we are now. Could you begin by explaining a little of what this report that's come out is and what it means for emergency management work around the country quite broadly?
Probably in terms of really what it presents is the complexity, and I you know, my personal view is really what people probably assume to be a slow lead into the impact of climate change and climatic impact. That's really manifested itself, I think, nationally in terms of really where those regions have been highlighted there. So particularly in the, you know, the other key aspect as well, just sort of highlights how vulnerable, particularly those in risk areas are. You know, now that we've seen the impact and the significant the frequency and the impact of what you know, we're dealing with in terms of events, particularly severe weather.
9 of the communities flagged in this report are in your Tairawhiti district. Obviously, this hasn't come as news to you as you've faced flooding events in the recent past. What do the flood protection projects look like currently in your council's 10-year plan?
Yeah, so, I mean, the active ones that are underway at the moment is the Waipawa, which is that's the main river catchment that runs through the Poverty Bay. There's obviously communities along the length of that. Quite a major system in itself, so that's underway. One of the other projects we've co-partnered with all of our iwi and Te Puni Kōkiri is really focusing on our remote rural, well, primarily remote communities, and remote in our sense is really anything outside the urban boundary. So if you look at the geography, particularly for Tairawhiti, it's really you've got very tenuous road infrastructure that connects communities is one of our challenges. Equally, the impact in terms of how fragile that infrastructure is means that really our ability to mitigate risk focuses on how we can actually then support communities in times of isolation or and even to significant events, particularly with tsunami being quite a, certainly in our top five hazards. So what that means, you know, we have a very active engagement aspect in terms of our communities, both for response, the way we connect welfare, and our recent launch and what we were able to show everyone at the recent AMP show is the emergency pods which are going into the district from the start of next year. So they have the ability to shelter in the Ngāti Pro area, which is the area north pretty much of Gisborne. The iwi itself is putting an additional 20-foot container full of food stocks that we manage alongside another container with the emergency equipment that we're putting in those as well. Quite complex. Mm. We're dealing with, you haven't got even within terms of cell coverage or communications coverage, but that's really where we work on in terms of the hazard awareness and the alerting system that we use to at least activate communities to let them know something's coming their way that could hurt them.
I understand that some regions, which may be yourself, are having to have conversations with isolated communities about damaged roads because they're not able to be fixed. Is that something that you're experiencing?
Oh, for sure. Look, that's a challenge. The reality, you've got a population base of 50,000 here, thereabouts. If you then look at what's your ratepayer base within the makeup of that overall population, therein is a challenge straight away. You've got a resourcing constraint where trying to keep on top of road maintenance without severe weather events back-to-back, the piggy bank's pretty small on to start with, but it's certainly well beyond the scope of trying to actually even get back to remediate roads to a state that people would see if you're driving through Auckland. Hopefully you've got no potholes in Auckland. But
not that I've seen recently. Yeah, but I think, your district's mayor picked up on that has said that because much of Tairawhiti is a high deprivation community, I guess your flood responses can't be leveraged off rates. How, in terms of this report, how would you hope to see the government work within these limitations and support you in that area?
Look, this is probably outside of my remit in terms of the economics and everything else here, but it certainly is, our role, and we're certainly in times of need is where we come in to coordinate and facilitate really emergency response and equally setting the conditions for recovery. The key thing really is that, there has to be a sort of a recognition of the constraint, which is certainly resource. I guess within that, you need to be able to lean on central government in terms of some way to be able to co-fund. What is sort of risk mitigation, whether that's in the priority and how that sits in place there. But it's as a region, trying to do it by yourself is a real challenge.
Mm. And the report says that managed retreats, which includes total abandonment of vulnerable areas, is on the table with this report. How do you think that would play out in the areas that you look after in your community? Is that realistic?
That's a good question. I think that's a consultation piece. But you've got particularly, what are probably identified as critical high-risk areas, and some of those we've had for some time within the catchment, they're within our managed catchment, so and by that I'd mean that they'd be certainly highly susceptible, prone to severe weather, which results in very much a modelled flood zonal area. I'd probably look in the last 2 years, what we've seen is other catchments now that are very much impacted by the way we've seen the intensities and the way that the cells come into the region. So, that's the consultation components, but equally using that language, it's certainly not 2 years ago people talking about coastal retreat wouldn't know what you're talking about. For some, really, it's just that, there are some quite tenuous properties out there where physically you're at risk by the fact the sea's almost lapping through your front door. And I think a time frame of 5 to 10 years, and I'm not a scientist, but I have a scientist on my team, you're going to see, I guess most New Zealand coastline, to be fair in that regard, where this starts manifesting itself in terms of really planning, just ability to keep living where you have done. And that's, unfortunately, you know, there's some courageous conversations to be had or engaged with to try and get people connected to the kaupapa in that regard.
Mm. And can we finally pick up on that? I've seen a few criticisms this morning about a lack of Māori consultancy on the report. Is that something that's of concern to you and that you've picked up on with the iwi in your area?
If you're not dealing in our space, and even as a region, I mean, we're 55% of our population is iwi Māori. I mean, myself, I've been brought up on the coast, and even using the word deprivation index, I don't come from a deprived or deprived community. I mean, the way we live is where we live. But equally, you know, not having been privy to the report, I mean, we've certainly seen that there's been a report produced, which was yesterday. You know, even partnering with the likes of, you know, entities such as council and, you know, all your key stakeholders. And if you haven't got iwi in the mix there, then you're really not demonstrating partnership to be able to speak on their behalf then. So in that regard, you know, look, we wouldn't be doing producing works like this here without really involving our key partners for that.
Ben went on to tell me that the region is still drying out from flooding events that started last year. He says there are some really resilient areas, but that the resilience that is required under the impact of climate change is far beyond anything that's expected. That's it for the Green Desk this week. Thank you very much for tuning in. We will catch you next week.
You've been listening to the Green Desk with Francis on 95BFM.
That was Francis chatting to Ben Green on the Green Desk. After a very exciting race for Bird of the Year, I spoke with Alan Rikers about how to keep up the excitement around our native birds and how to protect the underbirds that we discovered through the competition. The Rock Wren won Bird of the Year this year. Would you like to tell us a little bit about that?
This year, the Piwowo, or Rock Wren, took out the top spot. This adorable little bird, about the weight of a mellow puff, and they're kind of this gorgeous olive green colour with long legs and feet like snowshoes with crampons for traversing their alpine habitat. So rock wrens are New Zealand's only true alpine bird. They spend their entire lives completely above the bushline, up amongst the scree. From egg to parent, they're up there. So they're pretty intrepid wee mini mountaineers, and we're stoked that they're Bird of the Year for 2022. But it was a really tight race. The bird that had the most number one votes was the korora, the little penguin. Of course, we use a transferable vote system, and people can pick up to five birds. And so once we ran that transferable vote algorithm, the piwowo came out on top.
So another question I have for you is, how can we keep up the momentum when it comes to interest and excitement around New Zealand native birds after Bird of the Year contest has ended?
Yeah, I think that's always a challenge. You know, there's so many things going on that are capturing people's attention, and some of those things are also really important things like cost of living and stuff. And so it's great that we have 2 weeks every year where we can talk birdie for a bit and celebrate our native bird life. But I think that, you know, there's plenty of opportunities for people who do love Bird of the Year to continue to express that love for our birds all year round, through whether that's through backyard trapping or getting involved in volunteer projects. For example, Forest and Bird has national projects across New Zealand, down south in Dunedin. We have people looking after seabirds like titi. Up in our Ark in the Park in West Auckland, there are kōkako. So there's so many opportunities for people to continue to show that love for our birds beyond Bird of the Year.
This year was all about the underbirds. Would you care to talk about what makes a bird an underbird?
Yeah, so I guess a lot of our native birds are underbirds in one way or another, especially because 80% of them are at risk or threatened with extinction. But we, in taking the underbird concept, we chose birds that are not just underbirds in Bird of the Year, in that they don't get many votes typically, but also birds that are underbirds in life, so they might be in conservation trouble. So basically what I did was I created a big spreadsheet of all of the candidates for Bird of the Year and then scored them based on how many votes they've got in previous competitions and also how much they're mentioned in the media and their conservation status. And then did the calculation and came up with a list of 21 underbirds that we wanted to highlight throughout this competition.
What actions can we take as people of New Zealand to protect them?
Yeah, so there are three big things that are threatening our native birds. So, of course, there are introduced predators like rats, stoats, ferrets, and those sorts of things. And so getting involved in backyard trapping or in a trapping program elsewhere is a really great way to help our native manu. Also, if you have dogs, being really mindful of, you know, if you're taking your dog for a walk on the beach, keeping them on leash in areas where there might be birds like our little kōrera or dotterels, and thinking about how you can be a responsible pet owner is really important. And then the second big thing that's facing our native birds is habitat loss. You know, planting native trees or trees that provide food for our native birds is one thing that people can do, and getting involved in habitat restoration. So we know that when we look after places where birds live, like our wetlands, that those places will then look after us, because wetlands store carbon and they help protect us from floods and they filter water. So really looking after the birds is, and the places they live, is also about looking after ourselves. And then the third big thing is, of course, climate change. So any actions you can take to help tackle climate change will also help our birds.
Talking Bird of the Year next year, is it going to focus on the underbirds again?
We always like to keep Bird of the Year a little bit fresh and interesting. So you would have seen that last year with the inclusion of the Pika Pika Toro, the long-tailed bat, and then this year with our underbirds theme. So we would always love New Zealanders to back an underbird, because we have more than 200 native bird species. So there's so many that, you know, the average Kiwi probably doesn't even realise lives here in New Zealand. But we'll have a think about that early next year and figure out what direction we want to go in. And for now, just give the Piwawa the spotlight it deserves.
That was Millie speaking to Ellen Rikers from Forest and Bird about the renowned Bird of the Year race results.
That was The Wire.
Korera te o taka katoa mo tēnei wiki. That is a wrap on the Thursday Wire. Thank you to Tava'a, Francis and Millie for producing, and a big thank you to everyone who spoke with us. That was Edgardo Valdez-Lopez, Anna Lucia from Auckland Cuba Friendship Society, Penny Hulse, Andrew Little, Ellen Rikers and Ben Green. And thank you for tuning in. I will catch you next week for more current affairs analysis. You're listening to 95BFM.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.